Kicking off a new week with a big show on Monday, January 20th, Professor F.H. Buckley joined us from George Mason University regarding his book illustrating the possibility of maybe part of the U.S. seceding from the other. Operation Fuel was the subject of the 4 o'clock hour, with their executive director telling us about a unique way they illustrate what it's like for people who can't pay their winter heating bills. And in the 5 p.m. hour, for a full hour in studio, Republican State Senator Tony Wong of Fairfield. You know what I wanted to start off with today, and I found this, story really interesting. There's a member of the General Assembly here in Connecticut who thinks that legislators don't get paid enough. Now, Lord knows we talk to numerous legislators from both sides of the aisle. We do all here on WICC, this show, and Tony and Melissa in the morning, and Lisa Wexler as well. We have a lot of legislators on, and a lot of people think that they have a, you know, a smooth deal, you know, part-time legislature, 6 months, 1 year, 3 months, the out years, you know, that we have one of those sessions coming up. But we have a lot of people who say, well, listen, what they do get paid, and we'll get into that momentarily, what they do get paid is pretty sweet. But there's a legislator who rather vocally said last week, and I have the story here in front of me, we'll get to it, but, you know, we have a legislator who said, yeah, it sounds like a lot, but think about the fact that whether or not this is enough for somebody to step away from a, I guess you would say, a quote-unquote regular job to then want to serve in the General Assembly. Now, the reflexive response that everybody's already giving me on Facebook is, come on, these guys should do it for nothing, ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba. They should be happy to be there. Anything they get is worth it. Okay, maybe, but coming up after the break, we'll talk about whether or not, and before you go crazy, before your head explodes, is part of the problem we have here in the state about the same people getting elected over and over again, is part of that a pay issue? I'm serious about this. Hang with me here. 203-333-9422. It's 333-WICC. It's a Monday. It's Connecticut Today. You and I together on WICC. Paul Pacelli here on Connecticut Today. There was a story that caught my eye, actually, mid or late last week when it surfaced. Actually, it was, I think, first published by the Connecticut Mirror. In fact, Keith Fanoff published it, I think, on this past Friday. It might have gotten picked up earlier. Legislative pay. Now, before everybody goes crazy here, hear me out on this, because I think you folks might find my position on this one, for me, if you folks have listened to me for years doing shows like this in New Haven and Stamford Norwalk and Hartford and Springfield here in Bridgeport, you might find my position on this surprising. There's a first-term Democrat legislator. A guy's name is Norm Needleman, N-E-E-D-L-E-M-A-N, Norm Needleman. He's a Democrat from Essex. So he's in the state Senate. A guy's apparently very well off, so well off that he apparently spent, and I knew he had spent some personal money. I didn't know he spent this much. This Norm Needleman, a wealthy businessman who spent more than a half a million dollars of his own money this past, two Novembers ago, November of 2018, he flipped a Republican seat to blue, and that was going to give him an office that pays $28,000 a year. Now, he apparently is not accepting that money because he's been very successful as a businessman and all this other. And, you know, he's very wealthy, spent $500,000 to win this seat, and apparently doesn't need the money. And he said, he told the Connecticut Mirror, and it's been picked up by other outlets. I'm reading this version in the Connecticut Post. He said, quote, now listen to what he said here. Think about this. He said, quote, I hate to be as crass to say you get what you pay for, but we're paying people $30,000. They get a little bit of money to chair a committee. They get a little bit of money for mileage. And believe it or not, there are many people in that legislature who have to live on that, Needleman told the Connecticut Mirror. He announced last week at Monday's Economic Summit Outlook in Hartford, he would try to champion a push for legislative pay reform over the next year. He said, quote, "I personally know of legislators who've had to leave because of the money. They couldn't support their family living in basement apartments." Needleman, he founded a drug manufacturing company 40 years ago, and he's built Tower Laboratories into a leader in over-the-counter medicines, supplies, and supplements. Says here, Needleman doesn't take a salary or benefits from the state. He takes no benefits from the town of Essex, where he is, I believe, the first selectman. He does get a modified salary from the town, 10 grand of the 90 grand approved for the position, just enough to keep the line item open in the budget. So I guess he accepts 10 grand there so they don't wash that line out of the budget. Now, you may hear this and say, well, he's crazy. These legislators, that's the problem. Well, they get rich. That's the problem. And they stay there forever. Well, they don't get rich in this state. Again, hear me out on this. They don't get rich in this state. They never have. And like he said, legislators, and this is a fact that I've talked about for years, members of the General Assembly, you know, we don't have a full-time legislature. I get it. And I think at base, that may be a good thing. I think the less legislating, the better. That's just me. But we have a part-time legislature. They meet 6 months, 1 year, 3 months in the off years. That's the session that's coming up. And for a lot of these people, you go up there, and not all of them, I'm not painting with a broad brush here, a lot of the people that serve in the General Assembly have the kinds of jobs where they have the ability, the fortunate situation, where they can just kind of put those jobs on hold, if you know what I mean, or they can switch up or move around their schedules. So they can do the job. I mean, for example, there's a lot of lawyers in the General Assembly. Nothing wrong with that. We are a state, a nation, a world of laws. But it's pretty easy for attorneys to serve in the General Assembly because they know when the session is. They know what times they have to be in Hartford. They know what days they have to be in Hartford. And they can just, you know, have somebody else in their firm, if they are not a sole proprietor, say, listen, I can't be here today, so if there's any overflow of new cases, can you take them? In other words, their firms know what's going on. Or if they're a sole proprietor, they can just say, listen, I can't take cases today. I can't do new consultations because I'm busy in Hartford. Okay, well, you know. And that also goes for people like who are realtors, for example, people who generally have jobs where they have some sort of flexibility. You say to yourself, okay, Paul, well, what's the point you're driving at here? I think it's a simple point. There's a class of individual, not just in Connecticut, but in any other state, who can do that, who can move around their schedule, mainly because, not always, but mainly because, okay, mainly because they are in a certain job that allows them the ability to do that, right? It allows them the ability to do that, where they can, for example, not take any appointments, or they can move things around. But for a lot of people who may have some very good ideas as to how to run this state, for a lot of people, they simply can't do that. I mean, God bless the lawyers, perhaps the doctors, the real estate people, maybe some banking people, a lot of upper income people. And I know the General Assembly is not totally made of upper income people. But let's face it, if you want to attempt to serve in the legislature here in Connecticut, you've got to have the scenario where you have flexibility in your schedule. And you also have to have the kind of scenario that says, you know what, I really don't need this money. It's nice, but can you live on $28,000 a year? Now, I got more to add on this, but think about that. We have a YouTube question. Check that, a Facebook question set up on this. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. And also, it may surprise you that I agree with Democrat State Senator Norm Needleman out of Essex. I think the General Assembly, and I know people are going to say, what? Is this the guy we listen to every day? Listen, I don't march in lockstep to any sort of, any sort of mode of thinking here. I think the state has to look at raising the pay for legislators. Now, before you go crazy, think about this. Do you think maybe the reason, and I know it's not all the reason, but do you think maybe the same people that keep getting elected over and over and over again run over and over and over again because the salary is just coffee money to them? I mean, look at, again, hear me out on this. And by the way, this is our Facebook question today. The salaries that we pay legislators in Connecticut, which aren't chicken feed for a part-time legislature. I get that. People say, well, you know, it is $28,000 and they get a mileage stipend. And if you're a chair of a committee or if you do this or that, that actually pushes it up to about, geez, I don't know, $35,000, $38,000. Okay. But still, if you're a successful, if you have a thriving, I don't know, if you're a sole proprietor and you're a plumber or you're an electrician, or you do home improvements, you do carpentry, you do kitchen improvements, you do driveway work, you do any of that. Is it possible for a person like that, the way the General Assembly is structured and the way that the realities are here in Connecticut, is it possible to put your job on hold? I mean, is it possible to put your job on hold for 6 months, 1 year, and 3 to 4 months in the off years to become a legislator? Or is the pay kind of on that precipice of being so low that it only allows doctors, lawyers, real estate people, retired executives to serve? Are we squeezing out, you know, a segment of people who could possibly serve and have good ideas? Now, there's also a caveat I have to this. We'll talk about that and take your call straight ahead right here on WICC 600. Leading off with a topic I found fascinating to read when I was off for a week or so on vacation, State Senator Norm Needleman, Democrat of Essex, a very rich man, a guy who made his mark in the corporate world, spent $500,000 to win his seat. He's apparently not taking a salary, and he said he thinks legislative pay should be more in Connecticut because, you know, the pay now, which varies between about $28,000 a year and $35,000, depending upon your seniority and whether or not you chair a committee, whether or not you're an assistant majority or minority leader, because they can pad that payout. He thinks that's too low. And I think it's as unpopular as that might be, I think he's right. Because, again, we don't have a full-time legislature. I understand that. And people are reacting to this on Facebook. I posted the question actually overnight, late last night. I wanted to get a good swath of people on this. But the bottom line is, you know, the General Assembly meets every year. They don't go the whole year. They go 6 months 1 year, 3 months the next year. But how many different kinds of people can actually put their careers on hold for 6 months? For example, if you're a teacher, is it possible for you, if you're a teacher and you want to serve at the General Assembly, you can't do it. Because if you're a teacher, you're likely making more than $28,000 a year, right? See, it's not about money for me. It's about getting different ideas up there. And with the pay being the way it is, it prevents people from running. who can put their life on hold for $28,000 a year? If you're a plumber or a carpenter or even a police officer, cops make what, 40, 50, 60 grand a year? Can they stop being a cop for $28,000 a year? I know it's not popular to say give lawmakers an increase in pay, but here's my other caveat with that. Now think about this, and this may make more sense to you. If you're going to raise the legislator pay, okay, you're going to make it $50,000 a year, 60, okay? Here's the thing. You got to have term limits then. See, I'd be all for raising legislative pay, but you can't make it a career. My idea, if they're asking me, Paul Q. Public here, 8 years, that's it. 4 2-year terms. That gives you 2 presidential cycles. That gives you 4 budget cycles, right? Biennium. But I would say 8 years. I would say 4 2-year terms. What do you think of that? If the increase in pay comes about, I think it's fair. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. You want to raise the pay to where the average person can run for the General Assembly and not and can be able to put their career on hold? Okay, you got to make that 50 or 60 grand a year. But then I say 8 years, that's it. 4 2-year terms. That's 2 full presidential swings, right? That's 4 budget cycles. Even though it's 2 years at a time, it's 4 budget cycles. What do you think? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Let's kick it off today with John in North Haven. John, how are you?
I agree with you on the term limits if they increase the pay.
Yeah.
Also, there were 2 teachers in the General Assembly over the last couple decades back. One was from Bridgeport.
Uh-huh.
She was an elementary school teacher.
Okay.
And they put her on the B committees, which are only Tuesday and Thursday. The A committees are Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So then she'd take her time off of Tuesday and Thursdays, and then she'd take a leave of absence like the last month going into the end of the session. Then there was a lawmaker who was an assistant speaker of the House from New Haven,
yeah,
also a teacher at Hill House.
Okay.
He would take a leave right from January or whenever the session began to the end.
Yeah.
But those cities were more, you know, inclined to give those teachers time off.
Well, that
smaller towns.
Yeah. I mean, exactly, John. And like I said, some people, as you well know, you know, teachers, lawyers, even physicians, they can rearrange their schedule. You know, the average guy who might be a sole proprietor or gal, right, might be a sole proprietor, carpenter, plumber, like I had over my place the other day doing some stuff. You know, to them, they may look at it and say, well, geez, I'd love to run, but I can't. You know, the $28,000 here, if you're not a committee chair, they may say, I just can't afford it.
One last thing, and I'll let you go.
Sure.
State Senator Doc Gunther from Stratford, he served for 40 years, but he also was a naturopath by trade, so he could work his appointments around the legislature.
Exactly. John, thanks. Good to hear from you, my friend. Thanks. And that's the point, folks. It's that, yeah, there are people that can do this, but what if a person is, geez, I don't know, what if a person is a line worker, is a car mechanic somewhere at a local dealership. And they, you know, and he goes to his service manager, says, geez, I really want to run for the, you know, the state senator, the state house. And his service manager may say, well, that's a gallant thing to do, but I can't lose you. We're backed up with appointments. Now, would there be people, businesses who may try and accommodate that? There might be. But again, if you're going to increase legislative pay, as Senator Needleman has talked about here, to widen the scope of people who may want to do this, because you know there are people out there that are saying, gosh darn it, I'd love to run for the General Assembly, but $28,000 a year for 6 months, I can't put my life on hold for that. If you do that, you gotta have term limits. You must, because if you go to 50, 60 grand a year, you can't allow that to be a full-time job for, I think, 8 years is fair. I think, you know, 4 election cycles, and then that's it. You're done. Let us, before we go to traffic and weather together, talk to Steve in Bridgeport. Hey there, Steve. You're on WICC.
Hey, welcome back from your vacation. Good to hear your familiar voice again, Mr. PP.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. What do you think of this whole thing?
Okay. I agree with you 100% about what you're talking about. That's
okay.
Number one.
Yep.
Number two, I'm in the home remodeling business. Plumber is going to be not a plumber for $28,000 for 6 months. Believe me.
Exactly.
I pay them. When, you know, they're up to, you know, they do a bathroom. It's $1,000 a fixture, $3,000. They're not going to be doing, you know. However, to your point, if someone has a business like who's the guy that advertises on WICC, the AC guy, Steve Basso.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, he has what's called a business. He gets paid whether he's there or not.
Yeah, I know.
I know a couple of business people.
Yeah.
Now, those kind of plumber-ish, carpenter-ish, whatever, they can probably do it.
Sure.
But it would have to be a better salary. Because now they can make some calls in the morning or when they have break. There's a lot of standing around. But to your point, a guy who's a sole proprietor, carpenter, plumber, painter, whatever, you could lose clients. And you're not going to do something for less pay and then not stay in front of your customers and lose potential referrals.
And, Steve, that's my
point.
I mean, Steve, that's my
point.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it's like, you know, and Steve, thank you for the call there. Appreciate it there, Steve in Bridgeport. Good to hear from you, Steve. I appreciate it. I mean, that, you know, and again, it's not that we dislike lawyers or, you know, real estate people or executives or like Senator Needleman, but I mean, the $28,000 is not. I know people say, well, they only meet 6 months every other year. Okay, so $28,000 for 6 months may be okay, and they get a mileage stipend and reimbursement. And if you're a co-chair of a committee, whatever, you can lop on a few more grand here. But even if it's $35,000, who can stop doing their job for 6 months for $35,000? And then be able to go back and, boom, pick up right off. Oh, all my clients are here. They waited for me for 6 months. That doesn't work. Traffic and weather together on the sixes here at WICC. About it all the time. We're in a divided nation. The division in this country is the worst it's ever been. I would think that maybe during the Civil War was worse. That's just me. Are we headed, though, towards secession, where part of the country wants to leave the other, like happened during the Civil War? Maybe, maybe not. Who knows how far down the line? New book is out, though, called American Secession, The Looming Threat of a National Breakup. The guest is Professor F.H. Buckley. He's a foundation professor of George Mason University's Scalia School of Law. He's written this thing. You see him all over. He's been on CNN, Morning Joe, NPR, C-SPAN, and a very provocative thinker on this. Professor Buckley, Paul here in Bridgeport. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm well, Paul. Thanks for having me, and call me Frank.
Thank you, Frank. Appreciate that. You know, you and I probably around the water cooler, the coffee table there, the cafeteria. Oh, man, it's bad here. It's bad. You know, I try to calm these people down. No, this isn't the Civil War yet. I tell my millennial son, no. We had cities burning every night in the late 60s, so you and your buddies can calm down and go eat your sushi. But, you know, you do raise an interesting idea here. The fact that, Frank, we're a pretty divided country right now.
Yeah, we're pretty divided. And, you know, I think we were less divided in 1860, before the Civil War. And you know, the threat of secession this time would come from the left. I mean, this time it'd be politically correct. See, you know, my view of this is the big issue is a cultural war, and the left thought they had won it. And after the election of Donald Trump in 2016, they realized maybe they didn't. And we're divided now. And if that's the case, imagine where we might be in a year's time if Donald Trump wins re-election and, you know, he gets to appoint a few more people to the Supreme Court. And at that point, the people on the left who are really rage-filled might figure, well, we just can't stand for that.
Now, somebody might hear you, Frank, and they might say, oh, come on, that's never going to happen. Listen, we swing left and we swing right in this country, and we had Clinton and Obama at one time. We had Dick Nixon and, you know, back and forth. Is our ability, Frank, you think, to be on that political pendulum, Is that still there, or does that worry you that, you know, kind of the internal balance of American politics, is that disappearing?
Well, you know, in the past, people talked to each other more than they do now. And, you know, during the Obama years, for example, it wasn't the conservatives who started talking about, you know, how horrible things are. This is relatively recent, okay? So we've got a cancel culture that wants to erase our heritage. We've got people who, you know, who would deny basic rights enshrined in the Constitution. And we just don't have the mechanic for people to get together and talk over things. I mean, the level of division in Congress is greater than we've seen before. I mean, more even than 1860, okay? And so where would that lead? And, you know, my suggestion is we've thought secession isn't possible because we have the example of secession 1.0 in 1861. We're not going to go there. You know, but I wanted to make the point, you know, just about every country in the world is got a secession movement or is staring down a secession crisis. And why do we think we're exceptional? You know, and we aren't, you know, not only that, but we're kind of over big as a country. You know, it's the bigger countries that have the greater problem in all of this. So, I'm not advocating secession. I'm just saying, you know, the left might want to go there. I think a better solution would be a kind of renewed federalism. I mean, secession would have to happen through a constitutional convention of some kind. And when people get around a table and have to talk to each other about these issues, they might think, well, the better solution rather than a complete breakup is something which gives more rights to the states. I mean, I don't want to have need a passport to go to La Jolla. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. But there are things where we should go our way and other states can go a different way.
And, Frank, don't we kind of see that now a little bit? I mean, we see that sort of with gun rights. We see that with a certain business law. We may see that again if the Supreme Court tosses out Roe v. Wade as a federal protection. There is kind of a germination of that going on out there, isn't there, right now?
Yeah, there is. I mean, there's sort of a mild renewal of federalism, but boy, is it mild compared to where we were 200 years back. I mean, I'd like to see us go back. Look, I don't care what the gun laws are in Massachusetts, but evidently Virginians care about what the gun laws are in Virginia. I mean, I don't care what California does about, any variety of social issues, but maybe we want to be more conservative in other states. So, federalism is much decayed as an institution compared to the past. You know, people still sort themselves out, but, if there were greater devolution or even a secession crisis, my advice would be to invest in U-Haul. Buy some U-Haul stock.
That's great. Professor Frank Buckley, law professor, George Mason University. Name of the book, The Looming Threat of a National Breakup, the main title, American Secession. You know, Frank, I think part of this is reflected in the push by many on the left to get rid of, you know, when they lose, they suddenly don't like the Electoral College. And I keep trying to explain to liberal friends of mine, I'm like, well, if you get rid of that, you've got the 10 to 12 to maybe 15 states electing every president. In what universe, Frank, does that make any sense?
Yeah, in what universe would that ever happen, right? I mean, when are we ever going to get the other states to agree to let California and New York rule our lives? That just is never going to happen, right? When you think about where we are, I mean, Obama got elected and conservatives didn't join a resistance. They didn't, you know, they didn't march down the mall in Washington in pussy hats. The craziness has never been, we've never seen craziness like this since 1860.
And, you know, Frank, I think the problem is that whether you love the guy or despise Donald Trump, he's the guy, Frank, that millions of people, I think on both sides of the aisle, maybe not in the way he does it, but he's the guy that millions of Americans have prayed for years. Oh, I just wish somebody would go in there and, you know, smash the glasses and flip the tables. Well, he's trying to do that to a point. And a lot of people, though, don't like it when they finally get somebody like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's he's busting things up like nobody ever has before, and we might somehow, many of us might think, gee, if only we're just a tad more polite, we could live with that. But the fact that people are sticking by him amongst conservatives tells you one thing. It tells you how totally they distrust the liberal establishment, the liberal media, the liberal newspapers, the networks, right? I mean, we've kind of had it up to here. And if we're willing to tolerate somebody like Trump, you know, who's got some issues, that reflects more on the other side, what we think about the other side than what we think about Trump.
Hang on, Frank Buckley. We'll be back to you momentarily. The guest for a few more minutes coming up is Professor Frank Buckley, law professor, George Mason University. Name of the book, American Secession, The Looming Threat of a National Breakup. Traffic and weather together on the sixes, and then more with Professor Buckley straight ahead. And we spend a few more moments on this Monday with Professor Frank Buckley, Foundation Professor at the George Mason University Scalia School of Law. And the name of the book is American Secession, The Looming Threat of a National Breakup. People may be saying, oh, you're crazy, Paul. There can never be a breakup. Well, you know, look at history. Look at hundreds or thousands of years of history. Frank, the thing that drives me crazy, one of the things that drives me crazy, and when I talk about this on the show here and friends of mine and associates, I think we have lost, Frank, the idea of a traditional, clear-thinking liberal in this country. Somebody in the, you know, even in the cast of a Harry Truman, a JFK, even kind of a Bill Clinton. You know, Bill Clinton ran today, Frank. He would almost have to be a conservative Republican. And I try to delineate the difference between clear-thinking liberals from, say, the free speech movement of the 60s and 70s to the out-and-out leftists who won't even allow free speech now, Frank, on some of those college campuses, you know, like Brandeis and Berkeley, where the free speech movement was born.
You're totally right. I mean, look, most people would call me conservative. I think of myself as a JFK liberal. And, you know, if we were talking about secession, and one of the reasons why secession should be thought less threatening than it was back in, you know, last 1860, is the civil rights revolution has taken hold, and that's not going to be reversed. I mean, if, you know, the issue this time will not be over the 1964 civil rights bill. The issue for the left will be things like transgender bathrooms. You know, you don't go to war for that, okay? So, you know, one thing we can put to rest is the idea that if there were a secession movement, there would necessarily be violence. I mean, that's just not going to happen. What would happen would be people sitting down and talking. And that would be a good thing to compromise over the issues.
Yeah.
Too little of that today.
No, there is. And you know, Frank, as you said earlier in our little chat here, we're drowned out. And God, I wish Twitter would go away sometimes. But we're drowned out by people who, the minute you have Donald Trump up there, they start throwing words around, Frank, like fascism, Nazi, totalitarian, you know, like they're Skittles out of a bag by the handful. These people have no idea, Frank, what they're talking about.
Yeah, and you know something, the problem is it's not just the wackos on Twitter, right? Every morning, you know, I'm in the D.C. area, every morning the Washington Post arrives at my doorstep and it's yet one more argument for secession. You know, I read what they're saying about anybody they disagree with and they just can't tolerate it.
No, you're right, and that's the whole thing. And the guest, once again, is Frank Buckley, law professor, George Mason, name of the book, American Secession, The Looming Threat of a National Breakup. You know, Frank, in a way, we kind of almost have that now, right? We have the D.C., New York, L.A., Chicago kind of cabal out there. Maybe you could throw, you know, segments of Miami in there and Austin, whatever, and everything else. I mean, don't we sort of have, I don't want to say a secession here, but haven't the lines been drawn roughly already, do you think?
Absolutely. You know, and people, you know, people say, well, you know, how can we ever have it? I mean, you know, how do you unscramble, you know, the egg? And my answer is, well, you know, my Virginia was totally divided in 1860. It took three votes for secession, and the first two failed. And you had the border states, you know, Tennessee and Kentucky. And then you look at the 2016 electoral map, and it's not just you're looking at sharply divided red and blue America, but the red is deep red. and the blue is deep blue. So, you know, those divisions are there already. And, you know, it's in that respect, it's a little bit like 1860.
And you know? And a lot of it, Frank, is driven. I tell people this all the time. You know, migration, the idea of somebody saying, you know what, I want to go live in a city. I don't want to have to own a car. I want to be where there's, you know, mass transportation. You know, I don't want to have the, you know, the white picket fence in the house. Well, that's fine. That's good. That's their choice. But, you know, as you say, blue areas get bluer and bluer and bluer, and that emphasizes the votes in the red areas of the nation, you know, the old addition by subtraction here. And it's the population migration, primarily, Frank, of young people.
Yeah. And, you know, I also get people saying, well, you know, you conservatives, you know, you're going to lose because if you remember the movie Cabaret, the future belongs to me, you know, all those guys, you know, they're totally woke and totally left-wing.
Yeah.
Well, you know something, people grow up. And generational change includes changes in politics as well as everything else.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, so that's going to, you know, those differences are going to remain.
Where do you think, Frank, and again, the guest is Professor Frank Buckley, George Mason, Scalia Law School, name of the book, American Secession. What's going to unfold, do you think, over the next year or so? What do you think, A, if a year from now we're talking and Donald Trump has been reelected, or B, a year from now we talk again and there is a Democrat in the White House, whether it's maybe Joe Biden, who would not be a disaster, I don't think, but, you know, it could, who knows, versus in a Bernie Sanders or an Elizabeth Warren? What are we looking at with the different scenarios here?
Well, you know, nowadays it's the conservatives who are tolerant. So, you know, if a Democrat were elected, even a completely socialist Democrat, conservatives wouldn't revolt any more than they did in 28 with Obama. I mean, so the only threat of disunion would come from the left if, as I think likely, Trump were reelected, and you know, that would mark a decisive defeat of the left on cultural wars. So, you know, at that point, one of two things are going to happen. Either the left is going to chill, which I earnestly hope they would, and realize you're not going to get your own way. You know, maybe instead of demonizing everybody who disagrees with you, you know, putting up those signs which announce how, you know, how completely wonderful you are and how hateful everybody else is, all those reject hate signs. Maybe instead of that, you should realize you're living in a country that has pretty good traditions and you don't want to, you know, maybe you want to stop voicing your hatred of America, okay? That's one possibility, and the other possibility is a move to secession.
Chilling stuff. Name of the book, if you want to pick it up, folks, it's on Amazon and all the usual places. American Secession, The Looming Threat of a National Breakup. George Mason University Law School Professor Frank Buckley, F.H. Buckley. Frank, it's been fascinating. Hopefully we can talk again. Thanks for the time. We appreciate it.
Hey, Paul, thank you.
Thanks, bye-bye. Once again, folks, if you want to pick it up, American Secession, The Looming Threat of a National Breakup. Can you imagine? Coming a woman I've talked to a few times, good to have her on again, the Executive Director of Operation Fuel, Brenda Watson's with us. Brenda, it's Paul again. How have you been?
Hi, Paul. I'm well. Thank you very much.
Thanks for stopping by. We appreciate it. Now, I know in the past you folks have done something called the Ice House, which is an interesting concept. It's coming up this coming January 24th. It's coming Friday and Saturday at the Old State House in Hartford. This is, boy, I tell you, Brenda, this is one of the best things I've heard people do to make a point, which is what you're trying to do here. What is it and what's it for?
Oh, thank you for saying that, Paul. So the Ice House event, this is our second year. What we're doing is we're building a structure completely out of ice. We're talking about 40,000 pounds of ice to demonstrate what it's like to be in a home without heat and electricity. It's a very serious issue for about 400,000 households in Connecticut who can't afford the cost of basic needs. So we wanted to come up with a creative and fun way to illustrate that point and also bring more awareness to this issue.
Yeah, Brenda, this is always something that you and I have talked about and the previous folks at OpFuel that I've talked about is here we are in Connecticut, one of the richest states in the country. Every so often, Fairfield County shows up as the richest county in America among the top five. Yet, we have an astounding number of people here, Brenda, who, have to layer up at night and shiver because they can't pay their heating bill.
That's a really good point, that there are quite a few folks who struggle with this, and it's really about the cost of basic needs across the board in Connecticut. The cost of housing, food, transportation, and home energy constantly continues to increase and rise, but incomes are not keeping up with the cost of basic needs, and that's why people are struggling with this. And thank goodness for folks like yourself who give us this opportunity to share our message, and for folks who have been loyal donors to Operation Fuel over the years, we're very grateful for that. So, even though this is a statewide issue, we find that this is a cause that everyone can kind of get behind, because everyone can relate to having a family member who is elderly and struggling with the cost of basic needs, or folks who, I happen to work maybe one or two jobs and still just can't make ends meet. So we're really grateful for our community partners like yourself who, again, give us the opportunity to speak about this.
Now, you're bringing in actually to build this thing you mentioned, Brenda, for, thousands of pounds of ice here, 40,000 pounds, 20 tons of hand car blocks of ice. Who's doing this for you?
So Bill Kovitz is a world-renowned ice sculptor. I mean, it's so fortunate that Connecticut is home to this gentleman and his crew at Ice Matters out of Cheshire. He works on the most amazing projects, and we're just lucky that we're able to grab him at a time where he's super busy this time of year. But when we first approached him about this project, well over a year ago, he was completely on board. He, his wife, and his crew, they put in 150% into this structure. It's really quite beautiful when you see it, especially with the sun is hitting it in the right angle. It really is a gorgeous display. And it also provides, something kind of fun to do in our city where really kind of hard to find fun things to do when it's wintertime, when what you want to do is just kind of stay inside and stay warm. But this provides an opportunity for families to see it this year, because last year we only had it up for one day. So our Saturday event will be focused on children and families, and folks will be able to come out and enjoy it together.
Now, I know in the information you folks sent me here, this is just not Brenda, some slapdash box of ice put together. It says here there's going to be furnishings and a garage as well. How's that going to work?
Yes, thanks to our friends at the Connecticut Green Bank, we have the Green Bank Garage for the first time. And our friends at Carter Chevrolet are actually going to be displaying a motor vehicle in the garage. So we're really excited about, what that's going to look like, because I haven't seen any mock-ups of what the garage will look like. So we're really excited about that addition. And maybe next year we'll add a bathtub and we can get you in there.
Oh yeah, that's a fun. Yeah, you know what? If you want to get people to donate, they will pay not to see me in a bathtub. That's how it'll work. Brenda Watson's here from Operation Fuel. So the idea, Brenda, is to look at this and say, wow, that's a really great sculpture, but to have people look at it, maybe step through it and say that this is how some people feel who can't pay their heat bill.
That's exactly the point. And, last year when Bill and his team were putting it together, I stood out there for a few hours to watch them assemble. And much like standing next to or near a bonfire, where you feel that heat coming off the bonfire,
yeah,
you could feel the chill coming off of the tons of ice that they were using to put this structure together. So it really is quite a spectacular display.
Yeah, Brenda, let's talk about Operation Fuel in general. Now, this obviously is to draw people's attention to this, but your mission really, and I know it kind of peaks sometimes in the winter because of the cold, but Op Fuel is really a year-round or an all-year operation for you folks, right?
Pretty much, yeah. So we provide assistance in the summer. We typically take the month of June off to prepare for our audit and reconcile because our program season ends in May. So we reopen in July for our summer-fall program that runs into the end of October. And we're finding that there are more and more folks, families, individuals who are seeking assistance in the summertime. Because it can be just as dangerous in the summer as it is in winter, in that folks cannot live in a household without electricity in the summertime, because you need the electricity to keep your food refrigerated, but you also need it for other essentials. If you happen to have medication that needs to be refrigerated, or if you have infant, you know, baby bottles that need to be milk that needs to be preserved, for folks who have respiratory diseases or heart conditions or diseases like MS, they really cannot be in a household with the temperatures being high without electricity. You need air conditioning and you need cooling so that you can avoid a trip to the emergency room because the temperatures are rising. Heat stress and heat stroke is a silent and slow killer, and it can actually catch not just the individual off guard, but it can catch the whole system off guard. If there are a number of folks who are struggling because of heat stress, then that's our emergency rooms that are flooded with folks who maybe didn't have to be there because they had the ability to keep the lights on and electricity on at home.
Brenda Watson is the executive director of Operation Fuel. Brenda, hang on. We'll be right back to you. Get a little more into how people can donate and what you actually give people in the mode of aid for heating and cooling. Hang on. Traffic and weather together on the sixes right here at 416. How about that on WICC? Coming up to 19 past 4, the guest is Brenda Watson, the Executive Director of Operation Fuel, and we continue with her. They're going to have their annual ice house coming up this coming weekend. That'll be at the Old State House in Hartford. Brenda, talk about the actual donations that you dole out to people and what the scenario is here for somebody who may contact your organization and say, you know what, I think I need help here. I can't pay my winter heating bill or my summer cooling bill. How does that work?
Sure. So if you find yourself struggling or you know of someone who is struggling with this, you can do a few things. You can call 211 and they will assist you with helping to identify the intake site that's closest to you. And you can call and make an appointment, or you can go to our website, operationfuel.org. And we have a fuel finder on that website, which will help you identify the intake site that's closest to you. Or you can call our offices directly. Our phone number is 860-243-2345. And someone will pick up and help you find the intake site that's closest to you. Those are the easiest ways to access assistance. And we have 108 intake sites throughout the state, so I'm pretty sure we're covered in terms of being able to figure out where we can send you.
So let's say it's a case of a person, Brenda, who has a home system or, you know, a heating system where that uses oil. What would they do? Would you give them cash? Does an oil distributor deliver to them as a donation? What are the mechanics here?
Sure. So we make the payments directly to the vendor, so we don't provide any cash to anyone who's approved for our assistance. So what we do is send a commitment letter on behalf of the customer, and we send that to the utility company or to the fuel vendor directly, and then we send the payment directly to that individual. So that's pretty much the process. You know, someone will get an appointment, fill out the application form, And if that person is approved based on the information that they provided, then we start the process of making sure that the bill is paid on behalf of the customer.
And so obviously the cash donations that you may get from people, that is what allows you to make the arrangements with, say, the oil distributors, correct?
Correct. So 90% of all of our overall budget goes right back into programs and services for individuals who need that.
Now, what about, Brenda, if the person who needs the heating assistance is say, on natural gas and they're getting, you know, shutdown notices from a gas vendor, do you then forward a payment to the gas company they may be affiliated with to take care of their account? Is that how it works?
Correct. So we provide assistance with all forms of home energy, so that includes electricity and natural gas, and all deliverable fuels, that includes oil, kerosene, propane, wood and pellets, and if there's any other type of heating source out there, as long as the vendor is willing to accept our commitment letter, we will definitely help that person out.
How much help does OpFuel get these days, Brenda, from corporate people and maybe from the energy companies themselves and then from the corporate folks in Connecticut, say around New Haven, Hartford, Bridgeport, Fairfield County? How's that been working out for you?
It's been working out great. So Eversource is our presenting sponsor for Ice House, and they've been a longtime partner to Operation Fuel for pretty much as long as we've been in existence, and that's 43 years, as well as UI, very great partner to us. And we have five utility companies that administer the Add a Dollar program on our behalf, UI, Eversource, Norwich Public Utilities, Jouette City, and Wallingford Electric. Now, I just want to make clear that the municipal utilities are not mandated to run the Add a Dollar program. They voluntarily do that for us, so we're very grateful to them for that. And we also receive a surcharge on electric bills. It's called the Systems Benefit Charge. And as of 2015, Operation Fuel was written into law to receive $2.1 million from that fund, which generates about $90 million a year across the two electric companies. That's Eversource and UI.
How popular is the $1 checkoff, that dollar on the other on the big utility bills? What does that end up bringing in for you on a yearly basis?
So on average, we raise about $500,000 a year from that. And what we're beginning to see, because of a lot of promotion that we've been doing around that program, is more people are beginning to understand what it is, because very often folks will see that Add a Dollar on their electric or natural gas bill and they don't know what it's for and where it's going to go. 100% of that money raised comes right back to Operation Fuel, and we use 100% of that money to help people who need it. So we don't use any of it for our overhead costs. 100% of it goes right back to folks who need it.
Okay, it's the second annual Ice House, Friday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., Saturday, 10 to 4. Ribbon cutting is Friday at 9:30. This takes place at the Old State House in Hartford. 40,000 pounds of hand-carved blocks of ice, a suggested $5 donation per person is what they are looking for. Help out Operation Fuel, give them a donation and walk through that house and understand that's what, you know, on the cold nights like we had last night, we're going to have tonight, the next few days, this is what people's homes feel like. So donate to Operation Fuel. Best way to check that out, folks, online, Operation Fuel, all one word, operationfuel.org. Brenda Watson, thanks for stopping by. We appreciate it, and good luck.
Thank you so much, and I'm happy to come back anytime.
Sure. Let your people call my. Now, you have people. I don't have people. My people is me. So have Karen or whatever call me, and we'll set it up. Okay.
Yeah, we love Karen. She's our one person.
Yeah, she does a hell of a job. Thanks, Brenda. Appreciate
it. Yes, she
does. Thanks, Bob. Studio now, Republican State Senator Tony Wong of Fairfield. Tony, how are you?
I'm wonderful. Great to see you.
Yeah, good to see you. Thank you for bringing the little goodies there. Play the cannolis. Again, you and I, Godfather aficionados. Always, Tony, at the crime scene, leave the gun, take the cannolis, right?
Absolutely. But it's a treat to be here in studio and love listening to your show. It's great to say hello.
Thanks, Tony. Appreciate it. All right, let's start. Well, let's see. Tolls were dead, then they were alive, then they were dead again. then they were alive, then they were dead, and then about 2 weeks ago, we had your pal and mine, who I've known for 30 years, Martin Looney, come out and say, we have kind of this, I don't know, he used something that came out of a wedding ceremony, like a commission, a contention, a commission of conscience, or whatever it was, and now all of a sudden, it's kind of gone dark again. What is going on, Tony, with the truck tolls? What have you heard?
Well, the fact is, tolls is an issue that's come up more than Jason on Friday the 13th, and so many different iterations. But there's one consistency.
Mm-hmm.
There is no details. There is a kind of a grand idea of tolls, fixing infrastructure, but we don't have details. And that's the troubling aspect of it. This is all done in the dark of night.
Mm-hmm.
It's impacting hundreds of thousands of commuters, but nevertheless, the details are lacking. And we may even go into special session, but the reality is, again, we don't have any details.
Now, your caucus leader, our buddy Len Fasano, he came out the other day and somebody took some shots at him, and he, Len said, they still don't have the votes. You on board with that or not? What do you think? Do you think they have the headcount to do this?
I don't, because there's been a play between Democrats and Republicans in this argument. But to be honest with you, I think Democrats and Republicans all agree that infrastructure and transportation improvements are critical. We just differ on how we pay for it.
Yeah.
And that being said, there is a significant majority of the Democrats in the House and the Senate. If the Democrats truly wanted to do this, like they did with the minimum wage, pay family leave, an array of other agendas that they passed through in this session, they could have done it. As Senator Fasano said very effectively, you got the votes, take the majority and vote on
mm-hmm.
it. But unfortunately, there are many Democrats that are very uncertain about the toll situation. And nevertheless, nobody knows the details.
And you know, Tony, from a purely political point of view, I've been racking my head with this. We're in an election year. And I'm wondering whether this whole scenario is Governor Lamont, who I may not agree with on some things, but I think is trying to get things done. He's, you know, he's got a set of goulions. He's putting this right out there. I've got to think, Tony, that some people on the Democratic side may be saying, shh, you know, keep this quiet. If we keep our majorities after November in the coming year, then it's damn the torpedo. So I find that interesting, Tony, that the governor, it's almost like he's pushing his own caucus into a corner here. You know what I mean?
Without a doubt. But he's created that situation. Like we said, there's so many iterations of the toll plan. And it began when the governor was running as a candidate. And he said, truck only. And a month after he got elected, he said, that was not viable or sustainable, and we have to go through all vehicles. And that we went through a whole year of that debate. And miraculously now, Plan 3.0 and this latest iteration says trucks are fine. But you know what? I think there is a tremendous lack of trust, a fundamental lack of trust that people thinks it's only going to be trucks.
People know, Tony, that roads need to be maintained. They know that you have to fix bridges. You have, every time you slam a pothole on 95 and you say, oh dear Jesus, please don't go flat, please. And but yet you, then you take the car to your mechanic and he says, geez, you have problems up front, did you hit a pothole? Okay, people understand that, Tony, they know that. But as you say, you've told us in the General Assembly, primarily on the Democratic side, for so many years, oh, this is no problem, we just raise this tax, we give you this fee, it'll be great. It's, as Billy Joel once sang, it's a matter of trust. How do you guys and gals up there win that back?
Well, I think you have to respect taxpayer dollars. I think when you divert money from allocated special transportation funds to fix the general budget, there's a lack of trust. When you think about the fact that we have the highest gas tax in the continental United States that was supposed to fix transportation, and it's not. There's a lack of trust. When you have a fundamental lack of trust and understanding how this is going to impact people's lives without a plan, people, you're not going to win back people's trust because they don't believe you. And when you flip-flop back and forth, it really reinforces the challenge. And you know, there's so many different ways you can point to a lack of trust in government. the way the budget was done, the grocery tax that was a surprise, the 10 cents for every plastic bag that's been implemented. There is a fundamental lack of trust in government's respect for the taxpayer dollar.
And, Tony, it all goes back to, and I'm old enough to remember, and you as well, you know, it goes back to the tragedy here in Fairfield County, and rightly so, when the postmortem of the Mianus River Bridge thing happened. Governor O'Neill at the time said, okay, listen, we have to spend more money on this. So we almost overnight, we had a big tax increase, I think of the gas tax and other taxes, and people were promised back then, okay, this is never going to happen again. Thank God it hasn't, but we had the promise of that. We had the promise of a quote-unquote temporary state income tax. We had the promise of two major tax increases under Governor Malloy. And you're right. After a while, people are like, we can't believe you anymore. And it's sad.
Well, hardworking people that pay their mortgages and pay all the cost to be able to live in our great state, which is growing more costlier day by day, they ask the same question. Where is all that money going?
Yeah, yeah.
It sinks into a black hole. And the frustration is, where is it going to stop? And I think the idea that people don't care about our infrastructure, don't care about public safety, we all do, mm-hmm. because our loved ones travel on those roads. It's a political argument that has no weight when you understand that Democrats and Republicans believe we have to improve infrastructure and transportation for our quality of life, well-being, and our economic sustainability. It is a huge difference in how we pay for it. We should start listening to the households we represent and start managing and prioritizing the tax dollars that we take from them.
Tony Wong, Republican State Senator Fairfield, back with him after we do traffic and weather together on the Sixes here at 5:16. When we come back, I'm going to ask Tony about, why don't we ever do a complete state audit, top to bottom, soup to nuts? That's coming back right after traffic and weather together. In studio this hour with Republican State Senator Tony Wong of Fairfield, 203-333-9422. If you want to ask Tony a question, we can bounce something around that's on your minds. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. We'll have a little town hall meeting, although I noticed over the weekend the Democrats are calling them now. I saw the new acronym over the weekend. It's a community conversation now. It's not a town hall meeting. It's a community conversation where that came. That, well, you know, that was a consultant. So, I, you know, that's going to be my side job pretty soon. You know, Tony, I've talked about this with callers all the time on the show. Like you say, they call, they say, where's the money going? And from what I understand, from what you folks say in the Republican caucus and what I've read and I've had legislators tell me, there have been times where you folks have said, listen, let's bring in some, let's pay the money, let's bring in an out-of-state with no connections here, pay them two, three, four, these things aren't cheap, $3-4 million, and let's give them a 1 or 2 year deadline, go through every single state agency, analyze what they do, how they do it, are they efficient, what are they doing right, what are they doing wrong, and show us. But I understand that never gets funded, does it?
Absolutely not. It sounds like a great idea, but the reality is that would mean you have to have accountability,
mm-hmm.
that you would actually have to open up your books and show how you work every single day. You know, the transparency is shining of light, really exposes the flaws and the inefficiencies that exist so much in government. And we need to do more of that. Mm-hmm. I think that creates more honesty, that creates more efficiency. When we talk about the frustration of the incredible costs we have per mile of administrative costs in the state of Connecticut versus anywhere else in the country, and when you think about the timeline that goes to finishing these projects, I just get feedback from constituents on the Mayor Parkway. They've been working on that road for nearly 10 years. You know, like I said, we've built empires in a shorter time.
They
right?
built Yankee Stadium in a year and a half,
absolutely.
2 years.
Absolutely. And the reality is when we're able to replace two major bridges on Exit 9 and 95 in 2 weekends,
yeah,
it demonstrates that it can be done.
Yeah.
and there's a will and a way and a respect for the taxpayer dollars and efficiency, why are we not doing that and prioritizing projects mm-hmm. and creating efficiencies and respecting taxpayer dollars?
And, Tony, this debate here in particular about tolls here is really, really, and I've talked to Patrick Sasser and a bunch of people, really I think has illustrated two things, Tony. Number one, the ability, even though we don't have initiative and referendum in this state, and that's a whole separate topic, you can debate that till the cows come home. So we don't have that, but number one, the fact that any group, not just an anti-toll group, but any group now using a social media has the ability to say, hey, listen, here's what's going on. As I always say on this show, pay attention, Tony. And number two, the fact that this is not the income tax battle anymore, which was kind of pre-internet. Now with social media, Facebook, Twitter, the internet, I think, Tony, the future bodes well, at least for taxpayers who want to sit back and say, hey, wait a minute, I can look up all this information myself right now. I don't have to hope, quote unquote, fingers crossed, that somebody from Hartford's telling me the truth.
Well, one big part of your program and many of your stories have been to bring transparency, to bring accountability, and it really is an incredible asset to the community. When I think about John Lender's article from the Hartford Courant talking about what would have been $5.5 million yeah. paid by the state for a piece of land that just recently sold for $1.7 million.
Yeah.
There's transparency. There's accountability.
Yeah.
But if we didn't have that, the taxpayers was going to be on the hook.
Doesn't mean they're ignorant, but how can they find out, Tony?
But the frustration is the income tax, and being a bit of a historian as I am,
yeah.
the income tax was supposed to cure all of our income ills. But it has demonstrated human nature and government's nature to spend beyond its means. We have to stop that. We have to be respectful. And I've said it before. Let's say it again. We have to be respectful of hard-earned taxpayer dollars and the households that we represent.
Mm-hmm. Dave in Meriden is with us. He's up. Dave, hi. You're on WICC. What's up?
Hey, good afternoon, Paul and Tony. One thing I'd like to see happen, and Paul's old enough to remember this. Remember back in the day on the gas pump, you used to have a sticker that showed how much federal tax you paid, state tax?
Yeah.
That thing disappeared years ago. I think it would be a good idea to put it back and remind people of what we're paying in taxes.
Dave, that's...
They conveniently took it away.
Yeah, that's interesting. Dave, thank you for the call. Appreciate that. Yeah, I do remember that, Tony. There used to be the price of the gas and then the federal and local taxes. Do you have any idea why that's not there anymore, or they just conveniently got rid of it?
Well, I'm not sure.
Yeah,
but, again, there's just that nagging side of me that said the less people know about how much they're getting taxed,
yeah.
it'll more easily continue.
As a legislator, Tony, are you available, or anybody in your caucus, or even on the Democratic side, can you call the Revenue Services, right? Can you talk to somebody there previously, whether it was Scott Jackson or anybody who ran the tax department, and say, hey, where is this money going? How do you dole that money out? Is that like pulling teeth? How hard is it for you guys and gals in the General Assembly to actually get hard numbers on this stuff?
Well, we can request the numbers, and it's actually not Revenue Services. It's the Office of Policies
OPM,
and Management,
OPM,
that manages the budget process and the allocation. And you have the Committee on Appropriations, which mm-hmm. allocate the money. But again, we voted on a budget that affected millions of Connecticut residents with less than a day of review. Mm-hmm. We had over 600 pages of documentation that affected people's lives, and we didn't have the courtesy of a public digestion of all that data and fact. You know, we had the grocery debacle that came from a lack of transparency. We have many other taxes that people are starting to evolve and understand.
Mm-hmm.
Taxation, taxation, taxation. The revenue search never stops.
So you can get basic numbers, but
the idea of finding out where they go, that's hard? That's impossible for you?
It's not impossible. Stay in touch. Engage with your legislators. Ask to see the data point. Yeah. I think when budget data comes out, get the information online.
Yeah.
You can request it. It is on cga.ct.gov.
Okay.
We do a very good job of providing that information. But nevertheless, regular folks with busy schedules and busy lives have to dig and
sure,
dig to
yeah.
find
it. I mean, I've looked for bills, and it's a little tedious. It took me 15, 20 minutes, half hour to find one bill. Hang on, Tony. We'll go to traffic and weather together. Quick news update. We've got some calls stacked up here. We'll talk to Howard and Chuck coming up after the break right here. WICC 600, we're at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. And we are here for the remainder of the hour with Republican State Senator Tony Wong of Fairfield. We're going to talk about something Newtown did. They passed an anti-toll resolution. But first, before we do that, let's get to a couple of calls. And Howard's been hanging on. Howard, you're on WICC. Hi.
Hi, Tony.
Hi.
Couple quickies. If you remember when Ronald Reagan's wife wanted to end the problem with drugs, she came up with a phrase, just say no. Now, it didn't work for the drugs, but maybe, just maybe, if you got all of your legislators and senators together to just say no to non-essential overtime, non-essential capital expenditures, the state might actually be pointing in the right direction.
Well, Howard, you're absolutely right. Households do it. Businesses do it in order to survive. But the problem is, you know, one of the things we don't realize in the legislature, we have every good intention to help everybody. But the problem is, once you provide something, it's nearly impossible to take it away. It becomes a right. And it takes incredible courage and it takes incredible fortitude to say, is it non-essential? And we can just not afford it. And that's the real challenge we have in the political process is we want to be loved by everyone. But at the end of the day, we're putting tremendous pressure on taxpayers and our ability to sustain providing critical services. You know, when you don't control.
Howard, you had one more question because we're a little pressed on time here. What was your second one?
One quick one.
Yeah.
Perfect example of what I'm talking about. And I live in Stratford. Our local guy, honestly, I don't even know his name, but he came by looking to get voted. He wanted to get somebody to sign his thing. So he gets on talking about, he's bragging about how he supported a couple million dollars for the renovation of Sterling House Community Center. I'm 74. I've been going there since I was, I think it was 12 years old for art lessons, chess lessons, Sterling House Ski Club. It's a great facility.
Mm-hmm.
To dump $2 million, I said, are you crazy? The state doesn't have that kind of money. His answer was, well, everybody else is doing it.
Yeah, Howard, thanks for the call. I understand what you're saying. Howard, thanks. Appreciate it. So, Tony, there's that always that question of what should a local municipality have to pay for and ask for its own town government to handle, like a youth center, versus what you folks at the state level should concentrate on. It's a tough act, isn't it?
It really is, and you have to weigh it on a case-by-case basis, because a youth center can be an incredibly helpful deterrent for bad behavior and provide supportive services. But I always weigh every individual need for funds based upon what is it relative to public safety, infrastructure to improve the greater well-being, and ultimately, how does it benefit people? And we have to make that decision judiciously, every single decision. And we haven't done that because the money has been easy, because we keep on adding revenue demands on people. Until we stop the spigot, we will never have the discipline to prioritize.
All right, we'll get to Chuck momentarily. First, traffic and weather together on the sixes here. We'll get to one more phone call, then we'll talk about what was recently passed in the town of Newtown. That's coming up here on WICC.
And we are here at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. State Senator Republican Tony Wong of Fairfield. One more call, and we'll get to another issue regarding tolls here with the town of Newtown did. Chuck in Naugatuck. Chuck, what's up, buddy?
Hey, Paul. Welcome back. Senator Wong, you're always interesting listening to your name. I always get you mixed up with the new attorney general, but I'm glad you're Republican. But you must have heard of all the studies, and Senator, and you know the situation about it's a big stock market thing for the rich with these gantries and the story of the deficits that it's caused with the same company up in Pennsylvania. Do you know about all that?
I have heard about that. Absolutely, sir.
Well, you've heard about it. Don't you think someone should bring it up on the House floor and the Senate floor and say, we don't want a company like this in the state of Connecticut? It's a big money grab.
Pennsylvania's the toll argument has been, in my opinion, a big revenue grab. And you're right, Chuck.
Not just a revenue grab. I'm sorry, but not just a revenue grab for the state or the state itself for spending more money. But as far as the company itself is pulling the wool over, Pennsylvania has increased their tolls because 10 times so far.
Yeah, Chuck. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. And Tony, it is important, obviously, to if we were to go down this toll route, which I hope we don't. There's the whole aspect of who runs it? How is it run? Is it run internally? Is it run through an outside vendor? I've had some gambling experts talking about possibly sports gambling coming up here, which I know is an issue you guys are dealing with. But, you know, one guy who's an expert on this said whoever runs it is a big consideration. So there's always those nuts and bolts things, right?
Well, that's what we said about the lack of details.
Yeah.
What we've been able to obtain is from good investigative reporting of people who said there was a proposal to create a independent body that's controlled by the Connecticut Department of Transportation, taking the decision-making out of the legislative process. I think that's a cowardly way of displacing our responsibility and taking input from the public. You know, what's remarkable is on January 5th, the MTA, which impacts all the tolls and bridges in the state of New York, raised every toll by a dollar without any legislative input. Is this a path we're going? Again, it's a revenue grab, and,
like
and I'm frustrated about
like
it.
Like Chuck just said, in Pennsylvania, there was a great op-ed that I know circulated around the state, I think aimed at Connecticut by somebody who lives in Pennsylvania or had experience with that, say, hey, don't do what we're doing because every year they raise tolls on the Pennsylvania Turnpike and everywhere else, and all that does is pay off debt service. It doesn't build anything new.
Well, I think the summation that I heard from someone was the fact that having tolls is another revenue addition that will postpone hard and necessary decisions on how we respect people's taxpayer dollars. And I believe that to be true. Every time we increase revenue collection on people, we pass and kick the can down the road and making difficult budgetary decisions. And that's the crux of it. And again, Republicans and Democrats all agree we have to fix our roads and create a better infrastructure.
Yeah.
We just differ on how we pay for it. And we're trying very hard for me as an individual to respect hard-earned taxpayer dollars and not be flippant and saying it's just another dollar. It's just another dollar because eventually people can't afford it.
And the town of Newtown, Tony, has just passed a resolution against tolls. Talk about that.
Well, I represent Newtown Sandy Hook just as I also represent the town of Westport. These are two towns that will be dramatically impacted by having toll gantries over their bridge overpasses. Now, we can debate long and hard as we have about the revenue aspect and the taxation and the lack of trust in regards to that revenue, but we have really not addressed what Newtown just did on behalf of its residents. The Legislative Council, with a significant Democratic majority and a Democratic first selectman, both proposed no tolls in this resolution because they were extremely concerned about the unintended consequences of toll leakage and traffic on their local roads.
Meaning people who want to avoid the toll.
Absolutely. Yeah. When you put a toll over the overpass of a bridge, there is only one other way, and that is going through residences, local roads, and affecting businesses. What the resolution came out loud and clear is that has representatives of that municipality, they have stood up and said in a bipartisan, unanimous decision to say, we are fighting and protecting the interest and the well-being of our residents. It's remarkable in all of our discussions about tolls, we have not done the homework to respect the communities that be impacted. And the fact that Westport will also have a gantry affecting over the Saugatuck Bridge and the challenges you'll have with traffic congestion going through residential roads and with the onset of ways that weave and in and out of residential neighborhoods and normally wouldn't have traffic, it's going to be devastating to the private safety and quality of life of people, but also Main Street businesses.
You know, and Tony, people would say, well, these trucks aren't going to do that. They're big rigs and, you know, it's just a toll, whatever. And I say, yeah, but wait a minute. At least in the framework of what we've seen that would possibly happen here, you're talking $6 to $12 a toll for some of these bigger trucks. They will try and avoid that. If you're going to avoid, if you're a trucker and it's a $12 toll, you're right. They're going to say, hey, I know a route where I can get this truck through. There are no overpasses here. I can scoot back on, you know, two exits down. I'll just take route one for, you know, 4 or 5 miles. It's slow, but I ain't going to pay $12 where I can figure this out to do it a different way.
Absolutely. And we're not just talking about 18-wheel trucks. The definition of trucks for commerce and short-term transport of goods and services, they could be potentially impacted.
See,
but let's go back. There is no plan still.
Yes, and I'm glad you brought that up because that rough idea that we saw, you know, reported on what Senator Looney said, well, it would only be 18-wheelers. Well, like you said, is that even legal? What if, you know, what if a federal court comes down? There's still the case in Rhode Island. What if a federal court comes down and said, no. That's giving an unfair advantage to smaller trucks. You got to tax, and I don't know, I know it's Class A, Class B. I'm not familiar with the classes here. But, yeah, I mean, they could come down and say, no, you got to turn the screws on everybody else here.
Absolutely. There's so many uncertainty, and we're pulling ahead with the idea that this is going to be a good idea without any substantiation, without any thought process, without any plan. And honestly, as I've spoken to many groups, when you simply ask them, do we truly believe, ultimately, is it only going to be trucks?
Nobody does.
And I will say, overwhelmingly, people say, inevitably, it'll be all vehicles.
Nobody believes that.
Paul, even the governor said that in the beginning when he said after intensive study, it was unsustainable. We have to go all cars.
Yeah.
What happened? What changed?
Traffic and weather together on the 6s here coming up to 5:46. We'll talk about when, if at all, this special session is going to come up in the next couple, 3 weeks. What might be tackled there? 5:46 on WICC. Okay, 11 before the top of the hour, 11 before 6, couple more minutes here with State Senate Republican Tony Wong of Fairfield. Okay, so you guys and gals, no Me Too on me here. You guys and gals are supposed to, you're supposed to have this special session coming up. Do you have any idea if, when, why, or what will be considered?
I have no idea. First, there has to be a bill. I mean, it sounds really fundamental. There is no bill with details to vet.
All right.
And I think that's critical for the people to understand the implications and the impact of any such proposal.
Yeah.
And look, the Republican Senate proposed our fast track program of a faster, it's an acronym that uses programs. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. But it is a plan that has details, and it's been vetted and reviewed. There is no such plan for the governor's program that we're going to vote on. So first, we have to have a plan.
Yeah.
And then there has to be a transparent process for people to have a feedback. I don't think there's enough time.
Yeah.
And ultimately, I do not believe there's enough votes for it.
And plus, you have to make, I know the governor can cut, you know, he can make 5% rescissions on the budget, but you folks are going to have some decisions to make on fine-tuning the budget, right? Which is what the short session is for.
Absolutely. Yeah. As the controller has intimated that we are running into a deficit already because the proposed budget revenue expectations have fallen short. That being said, we just have to have a much more transparent and accountable budget.
Yeah.
As we have said after the budget was approved, there are a lot of phantom revenues that aren't really realized that will come back and bite us. And well, we're going to see that in this upcoming session.
Plastic bags. You know, the Democrats for, what, $54 million over 2 years. That's not even close.
Well, there is a supposed agreement in regards to unions giving health care considerations back. They've never agreed to it. We've never concluded those discussions. Yeah. There are so many holes because there has not been a proper, transparent vetting. When we had the 18-18 tie in a bipartisan basis, even though we didn't get to a budget solution till almost early October, we had a budget that people knew what was out there, and it was vetted, and it was truly representative of everybody that we represent in our state.
Mm-hmm. Couple of other things, Tony. The governor again, I know you're not a fan of this, but the governor again has kind of floated the, you know, legalized sports gaming here. It's going great guns in New Jersey. I think New Hampshire just came online. Rhode Island's making some money. I've been saying here, before we do any tolls, let's bring that online. Let's dedicate all that revenue. You can have a lot of sappy Jets fans like me, you know, betting on the Jets every week, and I'll fill some potholes. But again, that's another thing that's got to go through a long process. We've been trying with primarily the Indian tribes, right?
Absolutely. Connecticut is very unique because the relationship between the tribes and the compact that was developed over 25 years ago that gives practical exclusivity to the tribes in any form of gambling in our state has really created a challenge to get to any solution. I've always been in favor of a open bidding process in which all comers can provide and offer the highest and best deal for the residents of the state of Connecticut. And I have a responsibility as a legislator to vet and evaluate the best potential offer, even though for me, philosophically and value-wise individually, I'm opposed to any further expansion of gambling. But as I would offer to you on this, Paul, it is, again, epidemic to how we think in state government. We're always looking for additional revenue, whether it be tolls, whether it be sports gambling, whether it be marijuana legalization. It's all about increasing revenue. To what extent are the societal impact and costs we've not measured? At the end of the day, it again kicks the can down the road for discipline prioritization and how we spend hard-earned taxpayer dollars. Instead of searching for new revenue, perhaps we should do a better job of sharing and allocating the money that we take
and
now.
And again, if you guys and gals are better at doing that, then people are more likely to say, okay, you need another penny or so or a dime here. I'll give it to you. One other thing before we go to our final traffic and weather break here, Tony. This 80-20 bill, I've done a lot of guests on this, the kind of just a bill to standardize the pay for hundreds of businesses who have bartenders and waiters and waitresses. You know, you guys and gals passed that just to make sure everybody was on the same page. I think there were like two no votes out of the entire General Assembly. We know what happened to it. You know, everybody says this should be so easy. What's the holdup here? Is there pressure from people who want to continue to bring these class action suits against restaurants?
Well, fundamentally, we have to look at our restaurants as integral small businesses in our community. They provide jobs, they provide income, and we need to understand that they are partners with us in the economic vitality that the state truly needs. What we were looking at in this issue was restaurants that were following guidelines set by the federal government and the State Department of Labor. And unbeknownst to them, there was a different interpretation, and that created this class action legal challenge. What I will share with the two colleagues that voted against the approval of the resolution was this. This bill did not have, again, a full, clear legislative vetting. It was tucked into a separate bill on trades training. And I respect their objection based upon the lack of transparency, the last minute dark of night insertion into a bill. However valid and however well intentioned it was tucked into a bill that people didn't have a full vetting for. So it's kind of how the sausage making is made.
Sure.
But nevertheless, I think this resolution is a good step forward to allow our small business restaurants to be able to function and manage, despite the challenges that we imposed on them with increasing minimum wage, as well as the paid family medical leave that we imposed that will go into effect.
One more check, traffic and weather together. We'll wrap things up with Tony Wong straight ahead on WICC. All right, as we approach 2:30 before the top of the hour here, Tony Wong's been spending the last hour in studio with us. Tony, thank you. It's been great. We will keep us updated as to what is going on. And I don't envy your position. I know you folks are you try to keep a calmer head up there, but you know I'm sure passions are hot and heavy because you know having to figure out what to do on a yearly basis with roughly $21, $22 billion isn't always easy.
It isn't, but it's something that I love doing, mm-hmm. and it's a tremendous privilege to do so. You know, coming from a country in which I grew up where there was martial law, there was no freedom of press, there was no freedom of elections. I really value the pride of American democracy, and to be able to be a part of it is a true privilege. And look, perhaps sometimes I'm so passionate talking about the things and saying things that people may not always want to hear.
Yeah.
But you know what? I know for me, just as in the resolution that we looked for Newtown and perhaps for Westport, I know in my heart and interest that I'm doing my best to represent the interest of my community and my district.
Mm-hmm.
There can't be a greater honor and privilege than to do that. And you know what? As my wife eloquently said to me, you know what? We don't even agree at home. But it's healthy to have that difference of opinion to engage. And so this is the beauty of America, that we have the freedom and the privilege to have dialogue and engagement. But we have to always remember at the end of every debate, we're all Americans.
Sure.
And that we're all neighbors, and that it's truly a uniqueness of America that we should cherish.
Tony, thank you. We appreciate it. We'll keep in touch. State Senator Tony Wong of Fairfield. Tony, thanks for stopping by. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Appreciate it.